Miff Warhurst.
Weekdays on ABC Radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Hearing voices is a common symptom for people experiencing mental illness, but there are many reasons people hear voices. Mary Robson is at the forefront of multidisciplinary research, which explores why and how people hear voices. And she is my guest this morning, along with Persephone Sextou, who works with theatre for children in hospitals, and also Nicole Jackson, who's going to introduce a concept I have never heard of called photo voice. Welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
This is a fascinating topic. Mary, let's get to you first. You're the co-founder of something called Hearing the Voice. Can you explain that to us?
Well, first, I'm not the co-founder. It's a big research project, a big interdisciplinary research project at Durham University in the UK. And I'm its creative facilitator, which is partly why I'm here at an arts and health conference in Australia, because it's about what I bring creatively into the academy, and specifically on that project, as well as others, around people who hear voices.
Can you explain it a little further then, what the project is?
Yeah, the project has a number of different disciplines. We've got everybody from cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists through to the English department, medievalists, philosophers, theologians, anthropologists, all looking at the phenomenon of hearing a voice when there's no one present. Now, usually if you say voice hearing, people automatically jump to the conclusion that it's a symptom of serious mental illness. But what we're discovering and making a case for is that it's much more part of everyday human experience than perhaps people recognise.
Is that true? What have they found?
Well, I think the more we look, the more we find. But you've only got to think for a moment of, for example, if has anybody ever heard their name being called and there's no one there? Especially
yes.
Yeah, exactly. You've heard a voice. As you wake up in the morning or as you fall asleep at night, people are often more likely to have those kinds of experiences of hearing and seeing things. Nothing untoward at all about that. Children have imaginary friends. They talk to themselves all the time. Part of human development. Not a problem at all. We all have inner speech to some extent. So we all hear ourselves speak when we're reading, or do we hear the character speak when we're reading? So we use our imaginations a lot in that regard. There are people who are spiritualists who seek to hear voices and hear voices all their lives and don't think any, never access a mental health service for that.
Yeah, well, in other cultures, quite often those who hear voices are considered to be quite important members of the community.
Yes, absolutely. And certainly in other cultures, whilst we aren't researching that so much, we do have some anthropologists with us who've looked at, for example, ayahuasca takers in South America and with shamanic practice there. And certainly it wouldn't be perceived as a symptom of illness necessarily, sometimes of wisdom or of... there are ways within those communities as well to nurture the person through any difficulties they may be having.
Oh, this is so interesting and obviously quite a unique approach to help people come to accept the voices that they might hear in themselves, that it's not necessarily a bad thing to hear voices.
It isn't necessarily, but it has to be said that for some people it is.
Okay.
And some people do suffer through it. So, for example, if you're in your mid-70s and you've got the onset of some neurological condition and all of a sudden you have a commanding voice in your head every day, then that's a real problem. If you're a young person who's suffered trauma as a child, you're 300% more likely to hear voices. And again, that can be a very traumatic and troubling experience. So we don't want to diminish the fact that for some it is a problem, but we do want, I suppose, more understanding of it and there to be less stigma around it.
Why do you take a multidisciplinary approach and what does that mean?
I suppose we would call it interdisciplinary, but only the kind of terminology doesn't matter so much really. Basically, we're interested in taking a long cultural view as well as the more obvious of taking scans of people's brains. So, for example, currently we have a psychology project that involves working with spiritualists, and it involves fMRI scanning and such like, and a lot of other psychological experiments. But we also have, we can also learn from medievalists who can look at texts from that time and realise that, for example, people didn't talk just about voice hearing, they talked about visions and seeing things as a matter of course. So that can make us think again about how we privilege certain kinds of sensory reactions to whatever is going on.
Persephone and Nicole, I will get to you in a minute and talk about what you do through your art that helps people who experience voices. But before we move on, Mary, I want to play some audio now from an exhibition that you helped put together. Let's hear it, and then you can explain what it was all about.
Thank you.
I went into the Hearing Voices exhibition today and was just overwhelmed by expressions of hope within it.
Before, all I really knew was what you see on TV or what, you know, the kind of stereotypes. And I don't think, I kind of accepted that it wasn't an automatic kind of indicator of craziness, but I hadn't even thought about things like the voices when you're reading and imaginary friends and things like that as all being part of the same continuum. So it's really opened my eyes.
Mary, can you explain that bit of audio for us, the exhibition that people were seeing?
Yes, we ran we think it's the first exhibition on the subject ever at Durham last year, and we involved a lot of people in the creation of that exhibition. So it went through different disciplinary perspectives. We looked, for example, we had some beautiful medieval texts there. We also had work by Virginia Woolf. We had work from Charles Dickens. And we had work by Samuel Beckett, the literary input. We also had a whole section on imaginary friends. But importantly, too, we had sections that were created and curated by people with experience of voice hearing themselves. So there's a whole section on the Hearing Voices movement, on its on how it began, and the testimonies of individuals, and also by people like Ray Waddingham, who is a prominent activist and voice hearer in the UK, around her experience and how there are lots of parts to herself, as well as the simple identity of being a voice hearer.
It is utterly fascinating and a new perspective, and I love learning about this. I am speaking with Mary Robson, Persephone Sextou and Nicole Jackson, all three who are bringing their ideas to the International Arts and Health Conference that's happening in Port Macquarie this week. Persephone, I'll get to you. Tell us about your work in hospitals with children and theatre.
Hello, thank you for the invitation. I'm thrilled that I'm here. Australia is a paradise on earth. So yes, what I do, I'm researching the impact of bedside theatre interventions on the well-being of children who spend a lot of time in hospital and others who suffer from long-term conditions and they are in hospices. So currently I'm leading a prestigious BBC Children in Need grant for my project Bird Island, which is part of what I do at Newman University Birmingham, where I am a reader in applied theatre. This project is about the intimate performance that we deliver bedside for children and their parents and carers, and is looking into the potential benefits of this type of performance on children's emotional health and the normalization of the hospital experience. So it's quite fascinating, and we have very positive results so far.
The normalisation of the hospital experience is something that they, I think, people come up against when they take their children to hospital. Why does theatre have such a powerful impact then within that hospital setting?
Theatre does have a powerful impact because it creates a bubble. a bubble of safety, the safety that is created by the dramatic conditions, a place where things can happen, the invisible can be justified in our imagination. We can escape from threatening realities and from difficulties only for a while. This does not mean that we ignore what's happening around us. This does not mean that we deny that we are in difficulty, but theatre helps us to accept it and to have more fun, enjoy, and regulate our emotions, because what happens within the story relaxes us. What happens in the story takes us elsewhere. For a while, it's not about the treatment and the communication of news about tests. It's about a dog that has run away in a cherry farm and is having a great time there with her friend Sam. Or it could be about a rainbow who's enjoying life with a turtle in a pond. It could be about anything that is happening outside the hospital. So theatre can bring that in.
Is there scientific evidence to back this up, that the story in the brain can have some sort of healing power?
Well, there's a big debate about the type of evidence that we need in order to justify our work. Some people argue that we need scientific evidence, that is like statistics, and they believe this is more rigorous and we need to link it with medical evidence. And some others are supporters of qualitative research, which means that we support the anecdotal evidence that we take from children, their parents, carers, nurses, actors, and those who spend a lot of time with children in hospital. In the minute, we have qualitative evidence, very strong evidence that I've published in my book, Theatre for Children in Hospital, The Gift of Compassion. It's interdisciplinary research that proves that children, yes, they do relax their brains. Yes, they get a better night's sleep. Yes, they interact better with individuals because they feel more trusted and more relaxed in this theatrical bubble, which means that by trusting more individuals, they take their medication more easily. They have a better night's sleep. They collaborate better with the medics. So we help them to reduce their pre- and post-operative anxiety. And there is also evidence taken from interviews with hospital teachers that these programs facilitate follow-up work, which means that the hospital teachers recall the theatrical experience with children, and they use that in order to teach the children about various subjects. So it's really important, this finding, because it shows that theater not only creates that environment where children can relax and have time and normalize their hospital experience, but it also helps them for a safe transition from hospital back to normal life, back to school, because they catch up with their lessons and with their learning, because they can relate to the story. So they do activities with their teachers about language, imagination, mathematics, many creative activities, and that's because of those performances that have been they have been offered.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear your thoughts on art as therapy. We'll move on to you, Nicole. Like many, you also work with the voice, but in an entirely different sense. You work with something called photo voicing. What is it?
So photo voice is a methodology that, as its name suggests, is using photos to have a voice. So it's really a technique for empowering people. It began in the 90s as a method for empowering rural communities who didn't have literacy or good access to, policy and politics to influence that. So they used photos to get their message across about what their needs were. So over the years, that's sort of been translated into the health field and is now increasingly being used as a method of empowering marginalised communities. It's very accessible to any group. So wearing my two hats at this conference, I'm talking about how this technique can be used for empowering individuals who are living with an incurable progressive neurological disease, such as motor neurone disease or Huntington's disease, in my work at Calvary Healthcare Hospital in Melbourne. we've developed a program and piloted that over 2 years working with families, so not just the individual, but they attend with their family member or a friend. And we look at what's their story, and they represent that through photos because a lot of them aren't able to communicate verbally anymore or have difficulties with that. So it's about using photos as their voice to have critical discussions about their assets, their issues, and what messages they want to convey to people that matter, whether that be their family, their friends, their local community, or policymakers who are determining the services they receive. So they want to have a say in this still. These diseases hit at a very active time of life, and they want to continue to live their life, so they're telling stories of living, not stories of a disease. So they can use their photos to share, you know, through apps such as setting up Facebook groups with their family and friends, which sounds obvious to us, but they might not necessarily be already doing that, so we can facilitate things like that, or actually getting the photos out to a higher level where some policy change might occur. And that's happened within community organisations such as local councils, where people have started up Facebook pages on council websites about wheelchair-friendly cafes, or where they've lobbied to pharmaceutical companies about medication styles that might be easier to swallow because they have swallowing difficulty, or they've lobbied other organisations such as Victoria Police to influence their policies over, again, wheelchair accessibility, or Bikes Victoria about, you know, telling them about the good bike paths that are accessible. So, you know, they're getting their message out through the use of photos.
Brilliant.
Because they can't necessarily communicate in, you know, a verbal sense anymore, but they still want to have that that influence. So, and then... Sorry?
No, I was just going to say, so you're working with people with neuro diseases, but you're also taking this to schools? Why?
Yes.
Why schools?
So in schools, obviously in education, there's a big push in public health at the moment within Australia and worldwide really, that the mental health of students and this conference is focusing on mental health and resilience. And we know that anxiety and depression are a big issue in this age group. And there's also a lot of evidence that arts can have a big influence in this area. So arts programs in schools are a big focus and should continue to be. And the Moran Arts Foundation have a program where they have 5 photographers. So I'm a speech pathologist and a photographer, so they fit nicely together with that whole area of communication. And we travel to schools all over Australia offering this one-day program that really focuses on, again, having voices heard. So the students get to outline what their assets and issues are within their school community or their local town. And again, the aim is that the policy makers, whether that's the school principal or the local council, can hear the voices of the students themselves about the issues that matter to them.
It's such a great idea, Nicole. I love it. I'm speaking with Nicole Jackson and Persephone Sextou and also Mary Robson, who are all bringing their incredible ideas, kind of mind-blowing ideas, I think, about creativity and health to the International Arts and Health Conference in Port Macquarie. This week, back to you, Mary, back to your voice work. It must come as an enormous relief for voice hearers to come together and share their experiences.
I think it can. It certainly, I hear from the World Hearing Voices Congress, I've been honoured enough to attend that once, of how powerful it is for people to realise that they can share experience and do more than just share it, but actually do something about it. I've also had experience working as a facilitator with young people who hear voices, and that group, and that was towards that exhibition that we heard about before. And we worked with young people who had never met, most of them had never met another person who'd heard a voice before. So to meet somebody like Ray Waddingham, who I mentioned earlier, who worked alongside me for those workshops, was incredibly powerful for them. To see that you could get to a point where you could live with your voices. And they created some very powerful pieces of artwork for the exhibition, so that their voice was heard in that way too, of how they wanted people to speak to them and react to them. and not to judge them, and to try and understand their experiences more.
Of course. And I can imagine lots of people listening to this who would be wishing that they'd known of your work a long time ago. Can this research on hearing voices be useful for all of us, Mary?
I hope so in the end. I think there's lots of the work that is accessible, and more to the point, we are very keen to make it so. We, as you know, we already have a website, but we are planning, as a legacy of the project, we're currently in year 6 of 8 years, we're planning to launch a website, hopefully, called Understanding Voices. And we plan that for to be a one-stop shop for folk who possibly are having an experience or know somebody who's having an experience for the first time, for example, not simply to signpost to services, but rather to explore all the different aspects of it,
yep.
and to make it understandable that it's not necessarily the worst news.
Yeah. Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing your learnings with us today. Dr. Persephone Sextou, reader in applied theatre, Newman University in Birmingham. Mary Robson, research associate at the Institute for Medical Humanities in Durham University. And Nicole Jackson, who is a speech pathologist and photo voice program producer. Fascinating stuff.
This is Miff Warhurst on ABC Radio.